what do you want to do, Gwyn? Do you want?
Okay.
Right. Well, anybody got any questions?
Do you think it's been said that, that actually due to the Second World War and working class had the opportunity to open their eyes up through what they experienced, that led the way to the Labour government coming in after the Second World War? What's your feeling about that?
I'm sure that's right. I'm sure it's true, and it's well observed at the time. And officers were very upset about what was called the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, which was the political propaganda, educational wing of the British Army, which organised many quite interesting talks. And their talks were quite radical, but within a limit point. You know, they were radical in that they were for the Labour Party and for the welfare state, but they weren't for socialism. They were, you know, there was they weren't for socialism in the full sense of social control of the means of production. They were for a Labour Party in government, organising capitalism in a slightly fairer way, and it did have a massive impact. And people have different views. I met yesterday a very good historian, Donny Gluckstein, who's by chance has also written a history of the Second World War, so we're slightly arguing with each other about our different versions. His dad was a Trotskyist activist, Tony Cliff, who was active in the war itself. And he says that, as many people say, that the war radicalised people. It made people much more radical. And there obviously is a sense in which that's true. Like all huge events do tend to broaden people's experiences. You know, if you've barely been out of your own town for most of your life, to go around the world is an extraordinary thing. And to meet other people and to talk, all the opportunities are there. And also to have a sense of your own power, you know, that, you know, what people were doing was to organise practical, you know, like supply lines, and they were creating means of production and distribution in the midst of the war. And it gave them a strong sense of their own authority. However, and this is where I did very much disagree with Donny Gluckstein, lovely as he is, that in the broadest sense, the working people lost or were diminished in their sense of themselves, because even as they took great authority for what was taking place, they did so under the terms of the security of the British Empire. And often, I mean, modern historians, when they read back about the Labour Party in power, are often a little shocked. You know, they read that great socialist heroes like Clement Attlee and even Nyren Bevan were brutal in their willingness to suppress the Greek people that had been fighting against fascism, and you know, they didn't mind any of that. They thought it was right. They didn't think that they did give up India, but not willingly. You know, they fought it tooth and nail all the way. And also, they had limits in their socialism. Their idea of socialism was very, very limited. So they did think that, for example, the mines and medicine should be run by the government, socialised, some people would say. But miners often would describe the experience that they would come to work in the new nationalised mines of the National Coal Board, as it was then, later British Coal, and they'd be kind of disappointed, because when they got there, the man in charge was the same guy that had been in charge before. That in the head office, they were the same characters that had been in the office before when it was a private industry, and that even the National Coal Board, this socialist enterprise, turned out to be just the same kind of workers and bosses, albeit, you know, political bosses, maybe, rather than capitalist bosses in the obvious sense. So it's true that it did lead to, in Britain, probably most of all, it led to a sense of a Labour Party-type socialism. But across the rest of the world, that's Britain is a little exceptional, because if you look at the resistance movements in Italy and France, which were very radical, because of their loyalty to Stalin's Russia and the policy of making peace with the West, they were persuaded to give their guns over to the Allied forces and to be quiet and shut up and stop making trouble. And the period of radicalization is not that strong. And in fact, by about, if you think about what happened after the war, the Cold War was really a period of reaction rather than radicalization. And for most people, it was it tended to tell the story that they should be obedient to their masters and they should be loyal to the British Empire, more than it told them they should be radicals or socialists. That would be my view. But, people disagree.
I just wanted to ask, why should somebody's father, amongst others, interpreted it as a radicalising event, a war, away from probably their workplace, going into a field that was going to, logistics, as you mentioned, which means sending goods around here and there. Understand it as a radicalising period. I mean, in a sense, if they weren't on the front line and they're in the rear, presumably they felt a lot safer, but at some stage they may have actually had to go up there. So I was thinking in terms of maybe it's an artificial kind of solidarity, this idea of comradeship, is that people are forced together. They have no control, really. I don't know the numbers that volunteered for the Second World War, but maybe diminished after the First War, because it was up until 1916, quite a lot of people volunteered. Maybe coerced into it more than volunteered by, as you say, these leading figures, these authority figures in society, the teachers, the local parish, big wigs coming around. So in a sense, to be radicalised in the blood, in the heat of war, to me it's not radicalisation. It might be in somebody else's experience. But radicalisation would mean that we'd want to address the conflicts that give rise to wars and try to overcome it, to find out, to see that we're one country, and that's the workers' country. So wherever we are in the world, whatever the name of that country is, we're workers. We don't identify with the rulers or the people acting on behalf of them. So I find it strange that these terms like radicalization should come out, and how they thought they were going, if they were in control before the war, surely then they would say, right, we're in control after the war, which wouldn't be very nice, given the fact that they've been involved in, war, killing, bombing, shooting, and the rest of it. That they weren't in charge to run society, they've just split the people as they were before. They just went back to their homes, went back to their jobs if they were there. So that's what I don't comprehend, really.
Well, you're arguing with him, not with me.
Not
arguing.
You want to say something?
Well, I think that, I wasn't around at the time, but I think during the war, you talk about in the army there were these social education programs where soldiers were encouraged to discuss the future and what they wanted. So I think the ruling class was very well aware of that. And also the ruling class, their gambles, the ruling class of gamblers. I mean, capitalism, people who get involved in capitalism as capitalists are gamblers. They play the markets. And they gambled on winning the Second World War. And they realised that after the war, there would be a huge amount of rebuilding to be done. And their experience, like in recruitment, they found that a huge percentage of the young men they called up to fight the war were suffering from all the diseases of poverty, rickets, tuberculosis, malnutrition, all this kind of stuff. And they realised that after the war, they would need fit and educated people, equipped with the necessary necessarily abilities to sort of like get involved in the productive process, you know, to take advantage of the profit making opportunities after the war. And so therefore they brought in the Education Act and the National Health Service. And one of the point is that one of the reasons they brought in the National Health Service and the Education Act was that some Tory politician, I believe it was a woman, it could have been somebody else, but that's what they said, it was important. They said, if we do not give the working class reform, they'll give us revolution. So I think, you know, there is evidence for a kind of radicalisation, because people were fighting for freedom, they were fighting for a better way, as people do, for a better future. So that, you know, at the end of the war, something had to be provided to satisfy that expectation.
Actually, it wasn't a woman, it was Quentin Hogg who became Lord Hailsham.
There was, to add to what Danny was saying there, I read a book recently, it's a few years old now, but it was called The Estate We're In. And I couldn't believe it when I read that it was the Conservative Party after the war that built more council housing than any Labour government had ever. And I was kind of like a bit shocked at this. And now what Danny's just said, it all made perfect sense. It's because they had to give them some sort of like, you know, reward, otherwise they probably would have been a revolution.
Yeah.
There's a poignant part in your book, as you talk about Herbert Morrison shutting down the Daily Worker, I think, and a couple of there's closing down the anti-war left newspapers. Does that coincide with the socialist standard? Was there a sense of censorship of the socialist standard?
I won't know about that.
Do you want to answer that, Gwyn? Or I mean, what the policy that the Socialist Party adopted was that they weren't going to be martyrs, so they didn't actually discuss the war as such. But you have to read between the lines. They were answering on the Peloponnesian War between Sparta and Athens, and so that the Socialist stand wasn't actually closed down or censored, but they had a deliberate policy of not getting closed down like some of the anarchist papers were, but as I say, it was still post the war, sort of post the capitalism.
I think the record, the standard was quite more explicitly anti-war until the Thatcher elections came in July 1940, and then they adapted the policy that they had just said. Incidentally, remember there was a division of opinion over the Second World War within the Socialist Party. To be fair, I don't think we should pretend that there wasn't, and there was a significant minority of the party who supported the Second World War and generally would have considered themselves more along the lines of a sort of classical left-wing anti-fascist movement. Obviously, this split had come earlier in relation to the Spanish Civil War. It provoked this debate within the party, which was then obviously by the subsequent resolved into the position that we take. I would just sort of say I think it's always essential to try and take a sort of historical materialist position on these things. And I mean, I agree with the vast majority of the things you said. I mean, I like any of these things, they're very complicated series of events. I mean, I've always sort of viewed the Second World War as essentially two wars that merged into one. I mean, you were essentially right about certainly about the Pacific War, which, I mean, it was certainly, in the propaganda, the West, particularly America, was viewed as much of a race war as anything the Nazis came up with. And that's true. And, of course, the Japanese were pursuing an absolutely imperialist policy. And, of course, the war had already been going on for them since the mid-30s, 35, in Manchuria and China, and the whole sort of thing got caught up within the wider kind of conflict for domination with the European and North American powers. I mean, however, Marx did once say, human beings make history not necessarily in circumstances of their own choosing. There are very difficult questions about what you would do when you're faced with regimes such as the Nazis, that you say fairly unique. I mean, they were out to physically exterminate not just Jewish people, but everyone they considered surplus, inferior, and of course, the labour movement, which they started off with first. So, I mean, I think within the overall context of the war, that you can certainly make the case that there was certainly a justification for resistance to the Axis powers, particularly if you were in occupied territory. But of course, you know, what we're often talking about perspectives and groups that are so sort of small that you don't usually have much, you know, the overall sort of say about what's going on. But I certainly, and I a lot of this obviously is with benefit of hindsight. I mean, I personally, I've got a lot of sympathy with the Spanish Republican cause and, you know, the anti-fascist cause in general. But I mean, I don't want to make any sort of, you know, wider kind of generalisations on that. I think what I'll say just to conclude is, you know, you're completely right, and I see, you know, the Second World War as it goes out, living memory becoming increasingly mythologised and ideologised. But I wouldn't want to necessarily posit that with an overall, almost sort of pacifistic, you know, perspective that you should always sort of reject any kind of struggle to help, you know, preserve working class organisations and, you know, the actual political and social spaces in which you can discuss.
Can I say something?
Well, there's lots of things on the table. Do you want to get going? Go on. I had two thoughts. One on, because I do think it's very interesting, the whole question of, were people more radical or less? What were the governments doing? Why did they, given that in the end they were, I don't want to get into the discussion about the Soviet Union because that's got its own complexities, but here it was a socialist government, it was a Labour government, and they did lots of reforms that didn't seem to be obviously capitalistic. But I think there is a point, Scanny, isn't it, was making the point about there's a qualified sense in which these reforms were made. My mother, who was very ill, she was a girl in the Second World War, and she had a rheumatic fever. And, you know, but lots of people were ill. I'm not asking for sympathy. Lots of people were ill because the rations were very small, you know. It's often said in retrospect that it was the healthiest time ever and, you know, rationing was really good for people's health. I don't believe that, to be honest, you know, partly because it was made up by doctors who were campaigning for the health service in the context of an argument about what to do with the health service, which made me doubt the figures, but I couldn't swear to that. She said there was a certain moment just after the war, she was lying in the hospital bed, and Lord Strachey was on the radio, John Strachey, Britain's premier Marxist. He had been in the 1930s, John Strachey, who became a Labour minister, and he was in charge of nutrition. It was Hartley Shawcross, or shortly Flawcross, I think they called him sometimes, who was mostly in charge of nutrition, but for a while it was the great Marxist, John Strachey. And Strachey was earnestly on the radio explaining the recipe for nettle soup. This was his great act of socialism. He was saying, you know, the very nutritious nettles. Well, you can actually buy it in posh restaurants now, but then I think the meaning was we've got not much in the larder, having wasted it on this stupid slaughter, so you lot are going to have to eat nettles. And there was, you know, there is a certain kind of socialisation of consumption, you could say, which was just emergency measures. You know, it was just a kind of, like the National Health Service, that people forget that actually the village hospitals were effectively a National Health Service even during the war. It was just practical to make the people, you know, to patch them together, to get back to the factory. You had to have organise it, and there was and when they did, and Iron Bevan was in charge, and he said, I'm not quite sure how we're going to do this, because these doctors are used to being paid a fantastic amount, and I don't know how I'm going to get them, persuade them to support the health services. So I choked their mouths with gold, meaning that he made this huge payments to senior doctors, while nurses, of course, in the classic class structure that persists in the NHS, were the dog's bodies, whose pay was very low. So there is, it's always qualified, the character of the socialisation. And it's qualified to the radicalisation is quite, you know, it's back and forward, because it is true, Grace Boggs, who was active in the American left, a good friend of C.L.R. James, and she said, if you were in Harlem in 1943 and 44, it was the most exciting time to be alive. What she meant was that there was a great movement of people back and forward, and Harlem had a great influx of black people who were working in war industries and were getting into industry for the first time and had money, you know, had coming from relatively poor sharecropping experience, had, you know, money to spend for the first time. And there was a kind of a culture that was lively, that working people made amongst themselves, because you know, they were galvanized this way and that. So there was great opportunities. And you should remember this, we don't remember enough that there were points, that there is a radicalization in the middle of the war, when many people at the high point of the war were on the verge of saying enough. And I was amazed, I didn't know about this, but as I was doing the research, there's a point in North Africa where all different populations were involved in great arguments about what should happen next. So we forget, for example, that Egyptian people, the actual people that lived in Egypt, over whose heads this war was being fought, were really angry about being dragooned into the war. And they said, what about our freedom? Their big protests. You know, there was a great Egyptian nationalist movement for freedom. It was confused in lots of ways, but they'd had enough of being part of the empire, and they were protesting. At the same time, there were tens of thousands of Greek soldiers. We don't know, but, you know, people forget this completely because it seems so strange anyway. The Greek army in exile, which had been a loyal part of the Allied war effort, had fought courageously in El Alamein and different conflicts, was overcome with a great sense of radicalism, and they overthrew their officers. They had a mutiny in the Greek army in the middle of the war. They said, we're sick of being bossed about by these royalist officers. You know, we want to stand up for ourselves. And Churchill had them put in concentration camps in North Africa, in Eritrea, and in Egypt. And these Greeks were in these concentration camps, angry. And Churchill said, leave them, uses the euphemism, under the sun, which means without water or food in the middle of the North African desert. And the English troops in the Eighth Army, who themselves were in a funny position, you know, they'd been fighting this army, they weren't very well equipped, but they were courageous, they were hot and sweaty, they'd kind of they'd broken the back of Rommel's army, and they were hanging around, you know, thousands and thousands of them in Cairo, and they were beginning to get a bit uppity, as the officers saw it. They organised their own parliament. I mean, and you know, it was modest at first. It was only like the Army Bureau of Current Affairs. I found a quote. There's a General McChrystal who says, "I'm sick of the Army Bureau of Current Affairs. Every time I turn round, there's some Yid gunner going on about freedom for India. And what are we going to do if all these people start talking about what should happen next? We don't want them doing that. Move them around," he said. Every time, and this movement, the Forces Parliament, took off. You know, it became quite a lively movement. People were talking about, you know, what should happen after the war, what about the working people. So in the middle of that, they did. There was a moment when there's a communist called Bardwell who says, you know, we should be helping the Greeks. And he put a pipeline for water into the camp secretly. And Egyptian nationalists, led by Henri Curiel, who was Jewish himself, they organised for Greek troops who were under mutiny to hide in Cairo. And all these different movements were on the verge of saying, actually, let's do this differently. Let's not do what our officers say. And they stopped that. They crushed it, or they undermined it by invading Italy. And that kind of took the sting out of this mulling over of ideas. So there was a radicalisation in the middle of the war, but actually it was undermined because they hadn't broken the key argument. Certainly the British troops hadn't. They hadn't said, let's not fight this war. So when they said, let's go to Italy, when the officers said, let's go to Italy, Sergeant Bardwell, tragically, great man as he was, said, good, now we will give Hitler a good kick in. Come on, lads. And all the oppositional sense kind of undermined. So the radicalisation was lost in that way. So I'm saying too much, but you're making a very good point. You're making a very good point about what would you do. And the truth is that history was so concentrated, many people did crazy things. The Dutch communists thought that they'd be able to work with the Nazis, you know, offered their services to the Germans when they invaded, which was obviously very stupid because they took their names down and lots of them got killed for it. But, you know, they were confused about what the policy was. Lots of really good people ended up being fascists. And some of those fascists in Italy joined the communists and joined the far left and, joined the opposition to the war. So many people made lots of... And, of course, it was very difficult to know what to do. And, I have a great sympathy. In fact, I identify with the people that fought against German occupation when it was on top of their country. I don't know if I'd have ever had the courage to take up arms. Who could ever know that? But there were many ways that people struggled against German occupation, many ways that people, in India, struggled against British occupation. Many East Asian peoples, Indonesians and Burmese, opportunistically, perhaps, but understandably, thought that maybe the Japanese would be the saviours. And when the Japanese defeated the British and French colonialists, they were kind of chuckling up their sleeves, and some of them helped. I don't know whether that was right or wrong. In the end, you know, lots of them had to think, well, actually, we should be fighting the Japanese as well. But it was hard to know what to do. And I think the thing was, many, many people were in there. The appeal was, join in. And they heard that, and it was meaningful. You know, join in because what the other side is doing is so atrocious. But then, it was very, very, life became more and more difficult to obey the call to war. You know, lots of French... the French resistance, for example, became much, much stronger when they who was in charge of labour, said, we need some of those Frenchmen in Germany working in our munitions industry. We've sent all our men off to fight everywhere else. Send some of those Frenchmen up to, join in, work in the munitions factories. And they would send lists, and the town would say, no way. You know, we're not sent, send them to Germany in the middle of this war? You must be crazy. There was lots of resistance, and that, it wasn't, some people were very intellectual about it and thought, I will stand for France or I will fight for socialism. Jean-Paul Sartre was an early resistor, and he's been denigrated for it ever since by the communists, who hated him for being against the war prematurely. So lots of people came to it intellectually, but then lots of people just came to it practically. You know, if you look at in Greece or in Yugoslavia, where they're very powerful resistance movements, those people were faced with something close to extinction, so it wasn't that strange that they would be fighting against it. Sorry, that's too much detail.
No, that's all right. Anyway, more details in this book about the Greek region and so on. As we got a natural break, I'm going to pass this gentleman to mailing this for the ones that inform of in future meetings.